I think the psychoanalytic training that we've had has really helped us in this work to, you know, to know how to slow down, to know how to listen, to know how to wait and process material under conditions that can feel and really are very urgent, you know, cases that, you know, where there's a baby in grave danger or a mother in grave danger.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm a psychoanalyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. My guests today are Sally Moskowitz and Rita Rieswig. Dr. Moskowitz received her doctorate in clinical psychology from the City University of New York, where she first met and worked with Annie Bergman. Dr. Moskowitz is a graduate of both the New York University's postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, and of the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, where she is now a fellow, training analyst, associate dean, and supervisor. She is also a graduate of the Annie Bergman Parent-Infant Program, which she now co-directs, and is also a member of the Contemporary Freudian Society. Since 2002, she has been part of a team of therapists working with Beatrice Beebe on the Mothers, Infants, and Young Children of September 11th, 2001 project. Dr. Moskowitz has a private practice in New York City, working with adults in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, and with infants and parents and children in psychotherapy. She co-directs the Annie Bergman Parent-Infant Program Home Visiting Project, as well as providing direct services as one of its therapists. Rita Rieswig began her psychoanalytic training at the Contemporary Freudian Society in New York in 1985, becoming a training and supervising psychoanalyst in both the child and adult programs and on the faculty of the child program. In 1995, a group of analysts at the Freudian Society met as a group to focus on infant development and parent-infant treatment. In 2006, this infant program was renamed the Annie Bergman Parent-Infant Program and became a joint venture between the Contemporary Freudian Society and the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research. In 2014, an outreach home visiting project for mothers and infants was added to the offerings of the infant program. She also co-directs this project, as well as provides direct services as one of the therapists. She, too, since 2002, has been part of a team of therapists working with Beatrice Beebe on the Mothers, Infants, and Young Children of September 11th, 2001 project, and authored the paper, What is Transmitted from the Mother to the Child About the Father Lost in 9/11, in the Journal of Infant, Child, and Adolescent Psychotherapy in 2011. As you will hear in this interview, these are two very generous psychoanalysts. They're generous with their time, with their spirit, with their interest in working with patients who ordinarily would never see the inside of a psychoanalyst's office. And they're generous sharing with us their lives, their backgrounds, and their passion for this work. Here is my interview. Rita and Sally, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Hi.
You know, it's easy to think of the psychoanalytic frame as referring to something physical. It brings to mind an office, a couch, fixed sessions, a quiet space. But of course, that's not the psychoanalytic frame. That's the physical support for what we hope will develop into a psychoanalytic frame, which is a state of mind. It begins as a state of mind in the analyst, and in the intimacy of the dyad, it becomes a co-creation of each particular dyad. And then eventually, at the end, each party has their own notion in their minds of their own psychoanalytic frame. Your work in the home, the way you characterize it is you say, we take our psychoanalytic frame with us. Tell us what you mean by that. And also share with us the nature of the program, the kinds of patients you see, the problems they struggle with, and the kinds of interventions you're able to make in that setting. Sally, you want to start us off?
Yeah. Well, I think the frame really is in our minds. It's not only in the regularity of time and space that we do try to create when that's possible, but I think more in the predictability and the steadiness of our interest, of our responsiveness to what's needed in the moment, to the regularity of our capacity to help the mothers and sometimes fathers think through what they're going through, their intense feelings, the complex situations that they find themselves in. And sometimes we meet because of very urgent and difficult situations in a park or sitting on a bench watching a child in a stroller or watching a toddler play or in a coffee shop or go for a walk or, you know, buy somebody a muffin to eat. And while all of that is going on, we are nevertheless still in our psychoanalytic frame, you know, starting with where the patient is, with what they want to talk about, with what's on their mind. And I think the psychoanalytic training that we've had has really helped us in this work to, you know, to know how to slow down, to know how to listen, to know how to wait and process material under conditions that can feel and really are very urgent. You know, cases that, you know, where there's a baby in grave danger or a mother in grave danger. What we wind up saying or doing, you know, the actions that we take are highly distilled from what we know about development, from what we know about the state of a mother's mind when she has a baby, and from what we know about the urgency of doing something that will help in those circumstances, and what we know about transference and what we can come to mean to these mothers based on difficult histories with caregivers and based on maybe somebody good in their history someplace. And so all of that is with us in our minds when we go to these very difficult situations. Maybe Rita can say something about those situations.
So the frame that we've talked about that each of us as a psychoanalyst has acquired over time through our training and our own personal psychoanalysis is internalized, yet it is also portable and goes with us wherever we are. As we've said, inside the consulting room or out of the office in areas like the Bronx or Harlem or Brooklyn. So the frame does have to adapt and bend to certain circumstances, some of which are familiar to us and other things are not at all. But the idea of having the frame, I think, in your mind and then allowing it to be portable and flexible, it can be altered or adapted for each of us as we move along, is part of the beauty of the work, that we can see or experience certain barriers, but then have to make alterations and sort those out as we go along. So that, to me, is one of the creative aspects and the innovative aspects of the work. I think one of the other parts of the program that's important to mention is we are, in fact, working with mothers and infants in shelters or in foster care agencies, but we're also working with a host of other professionals, which makes it complicated. So we're seeing staff in foster care agencies, and we're working with people in the realm of law and custody. So we're having to interface with many different types of professionals. I've been, for the time being, receiving the referrals, which is in of itself a project that requires being quite adaptable to hear what people who are making referrals want and need in the way of help. And I think one of the ways that we're developing quite a reputation is that we are willing and able to see mother-infant pairs for as long as they need to be seen, which marks us as very different than a lot of other programs, which have very prescribed protocols and lengths of time that children and parents can be seen, around which then the professionals have to move on to somebody else. So that's one of the things that we offer that marks us as quite unique.
We wind up getting referrals of the most difficult cases, you know, the cases that are really beyond the capacity of the referring agency to handle, you know, cases that need more than what they can offer. And even though there are increasingly more programs for mothers and babies and fathers and babies in the city and I imagine in the country also, most of those programs are, like Rita said, time limited, or they have to present certain questionnaires and have many forms filled out, and they have an agenda. The worker has an agenda, and they have to teach something or assess something in a particular way and report in a particular way. And we're independent of all of that. We don't have to do any of that. We can come in and see what we think is needed. We can hear from the parent what they need, what how they see their circumstances, and go from there.
One of the pleasures for me of doing these interviews with people around the world is I get an opportunity to feel what they value about their analytic background in doing the work they do. And there's an emerging consistency in what I hear, and you reflect it today as well. You speak of the ability in the face of urgency to slow things down, to see where the point of contact is with the person, to reflect on a myriad number of variables, including especially transference. And as well, the opportunity to search for someone good in their lives. And what brought this to mind was your comment about your treatment is open-ended. I hear that over and over again, that analysts can offer, even in community settings like yours, if the program is structured the way they want it, open-ended treatment, which is so vital. It's so vital in standard analysis, and it's at least as vital in the community where consistency, predictability is a rare item in these people's emotional lives often.
Yeah, I mean, we work with our analysands for, you know, at high frequencies per week and for many years, and it takes a long time. And in these cases, you know, where people are in really dire straits, somehow programs are set up which are supposed to do something in a short amount of time and in a very prescribed way. It doesn't make sense.
It does have quite a bit to do with money, and that's not our task tonight to focus on that. But I think funding these programs is always very difficult because they're very expensive, especially if you want to do something that's not time limited. And so that's a chronic difficulty in keeping things going. But I did want to just mention that, you know, what we're doing to us, I think, feels quite unique, partly because we're dealing with a population that is very impoverished and has had really quite a lot of trauma. But there is a long history of psychoanalysts working in the community. And I'm thinking, you know, of Anna Freud, and also of, what is her name, in Michigan?
Oh, Selma Freiberg.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And all the work that Anna Freud did at Yale with Goldstein, Joseph Goldstein, about custody and the best interests of the child. So these ideas about working with very young children are not necessarily new. I think the population that we're working with is a very distressed and disorganized and hard population to work with. And that's one of the things that I think is vital about what we're doing. And that is that the people in the project are trained clinicians. They are psychoanalysts. Whereas in many other programs, people who are less trained are doing the upfront work and they're being supervised somewhere else by somebody that is senior. So in that way, I think we're also unique.
Let me ask you, before we talk about actual cases, I'm drawn to the image that you said earlier about you meet people in the park and coffee shops and sometimes you buy muffins. We know how powerful those gestures are, what they mean to people, how they can touch people very deeply. And I'm picturing someone, based on your description, of impoverished, and I don't take that to mean only financially, but emotionally and developmentally. And this kind, attentive, psychoanalytically sophisticated clinician comes into her life, and just to focus on that one image, and buys her a muffin with her own money, just to make the point. What do you find that means to people, and where do you go from there? I'm imagining the attachment is quite profound, that people, especially educated people, have not treated these individuals with such kindness elsewhere in their lives. What do you see the sequelae of that?
I was thinking about a child and mother that Sally and I visited every week for 4 years. And we developed a sequence, really, of bringing something for breakfast each week and sitting together around a little table. And it was pretty simple, an orange, blueberries, a bagel. But it was probably the only organized meal that they had together in which sitting and looking at each other and talking was occurring. And I think it became a really valuable moment for all of us to look at each other, to talk with each other, to hear something about the week, and to get started on our session together with that connective tie.
I think one thing I wasn't prepared for was really viewing extreme poverty. I had worked in community settings before, at clinics and in a city hospital, and worked with people from very low SES situations. But actually going into the homes, you know, the shelters, the various housing situations that these families were in, and seeing no furniture, no hangers to hang clothing on, you know, clothes in bags on the floor, very little food, certainly no toys, no sheets, just staggering poverty.
And so when you come along with your both kind heart and feeding them, what happens in their sense of themselves in relation to you?
I think it varies. I think sometimes there's mistrust and distance and fear. Sometimes that can be worked through, through the regularity and consistency and trust that can develop. I think that people mostly feel seen and touched.
When your description of the poverty, when I was a psychiatry resident in the 70s, the residency I was in was both a community psychiatry program and a psychoanalytic program. It was a rare combination at the time. And we used to have home visits, just like you're describing. And I saw just what you're describing. I was astonished. And there were, in addition to the very sparse, filthy room, smelling of urine, there was also a history of one of the children having been killed in an accident. So it's not just the physical impoverishment, it's the tragedies that unfairly predominate in the lower socioeconomic classes. And they are often the least prepared to emotionally deal with it. So you have to find a way to speak the language, which is what you folks do so beautifully in your program.
Well, and these histories of, you know, the parents' own abuse and neglect and the effects of poverty on them, their own having been in foster care, all the feelings connected to those events are reactivated in very powerful ways when they have their own children. And so that's very much what we're dealing with as well.
Yeah, and also I think a lack of having very good extended family contacts. I think that's something we've seen widely. When a mother has a baby, we know from what we've learned about these intergenerational aspects of having a baby is that the new mother might rely a lot on her own mother to be of some help, not only physically, but psychologically. And in most of these instances, there aren't support systems within the family, or if there are, they're very unreliable and very episodic and very scary at times, so that the new mother really doesn't have a mothering figure in her life. And so her wishes, I think, to be taken care of can be huge, but yet also be terrifying and avoided.
Can you give us a clinical example so we can get a real hands-on feel for the work you do?
Sure, I can start on that. This is a child I'm going to call Bethany, and she was about 20 months at the time that I am going to be describing. I began to visit her when she was 8 months old, and I visited once a week until she was about 2.5. She was moved to foster care when she was 2 months old after a brutal physical abuse occurred, which sent her to the hospital. She was then removed to foster care and had been living with her foster care mother during this whole time. The foster care agency was talking often about the idea of reunification for the child with her biologic mother, and that had been part of the plan, but Bethany's foster mother was concurrently eligible to file paperwork to adopt Bethany after she'd been in her care for 18 months. So I'm saying all of that to give you an indication of the complexity of this, that there are now two mothers in this instance, no fathers, and the foster care agency is essentially sort of doing two things at once, trying to work towards reunification while at the same time encouraging the foster mother to apply for adoption. So the visit I want to describe has to do with the transition between the foster mother and the biologic mother at the time of each visit each week. So Bethany would arrive at the foster agency and immediately begin to cry as soon as she entered the waiting area and spotted her biologic mother.
She's how old at this point?
She's 20 months at this point. Although the adults, the foster care agency people, greet her cheerfully and welcome her and often comment on her beautiful outfit or her hair style, she nonetheless cries inconsolably and her eyes dart and she seems overwhelmed and confused and disoriented. The agency staff and the two mothers, the foster mother and the biologic mother, try to minimize her upset by distracting her or getting the transition between the two mothers to happen quickly and for the goodbye to be painless. So I observed this over a long period of time and felt urgent to see what I could do. So I gradually talked to the two mothers about how we might make this different. I said that I hoped that Bethany might have some impact on her if we could slow the transition down, making it quieter and making it more attuned to Bethany. And in this way, we might bring her attention to what was actually happening. And over time, with our help and words, she might be able to be more in charge of the goodbye by being able to wave. And ultimately, she was able to say ba at the time of the goodbye. So each week, I would put this into words. And she learned the name of the two mothers. And she called the foster mother Mama. And she called her biologic mother Mama. So the names were incredibly close to each other and at times hard to differentiate. And so, you know, this vignette really has to do with trying to facilitate the transition so that the child would be able to navigate it over time. Her physical locomotion was very delayed, and so it was hard for her to really walk for a while and begin to make the separation happen herself. But gradually, she became much more adept. And so each time we set out for the playroom where we would go, I would try to articulate what was happening and say to her, remember last time you came here to play and you were with Mama and we were at the door and she hugged you and you hugged her and we went to the playroom and then you played with Mama and we pretended to make soup and then you had your lunch and when that was over, you sang some songs with your Mama. And later on, Mama came to pick you up. So I think this illustrates the importance of, in a way, the actual interactions and the repetition and sequencing of them, the tone of voice used, the reiteration of words, the eye contact, the activities themselves that built up a sense of constancy and safety.
And the modeling you were doing for the two mothers.
Yeah. Exactly. And encourage them to look at each other and to interact with each other, which did improve some.
Yeah, no, that's a brief moment of an intervention that seems so simple. And if one is not impoverished, it seems almost self-evident, and yet it isn't. It's really a special intervention, changing the mindset and adding words, adding verbalization, adding observation, adding interest in all the things that were lacking when you first came on the scene.
Mm-hmm. Slowing it down, differentiating the two names of the mothers.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's a good example, too, of the intensity of that situation and, you know, the complexity of the different feelings going on in all of the different people involved, including the people at the agency who were trying to have a nice transition but couldn't really make it happen other than to help the parents do it quickly and get it over with. But what Rita was able to do was to understand the complexity of what was going on there and pull out the pieces so that they could be processed and dealt with by each person and managed. So mine is a very different case, and I think it also illustrates how different the cases are and the situations are and how we enter them at different times are. This is a mother. It's actually unusual in that it was an intact family, a mother, father, a two-year-old boy, and a baby on the way. The mother was, I think, about 6 months pregnant at the time of this session. They had recently come to New York. The father had lost his job. They both lost their jobs in the city that they lived in before coming to New York. The mother had been raised in New York. Her mother was a drug addict and still lived in New York and was still a drug addict. And this mom, whom I'll call Dee Dee, was estranged from her mother. But she did have a sister whom she was very close with who lived in New York and who also had a toddler, a 2 or 3 year old. They had moved to New York and were in a homeless shelter, a family shelter. Dee Dee was very anxious because she felt she and the family were on a real downslide, and she was panicked that she was not going to be able to provide her children with a stable home, which is what she really wanted to do. She was afraid somehow the instability of her childhood would be repeated. And she was trying very hard to make plans about, you know, once she had the baby, she would go back to school or go to school. She would, or her husband would get a job. On the morning of the session, I got a phone call from Dee Dee saying that she had to cancel the session. She sounded very panicked. Her sister had been taken to the hospital because a very minor cut that she had developed into a serious infection, and she had to be hospitalized. And Dee Dee had her niece, the sister's daughter, And the shelter would not allow Dee Dee Aunt to bring the niece to her room and was saying that they would have to call ACS and the niece would have to go into respite foster care for the duration of the niece's, you know, her sister's hospitalization, which was bound to be just a few days. And Dee Dee was completely panicked and enraged and worried about how was she going to, who would she talk to? How was she going to make this happen? How could she allow them to take her niece? How was she going to pick up her own son who was in daycare? What was the effect of all of this stress on her pregnancy? How was she going to get any of this accomplished? And meanwhile, she was being made to wait and go to different offices while caring for this niece who herself was incredibly upset and distressed because her mommy was in the hospital. So over several phone calls over the course of that day, brief phone calls, we were able to talk about what was going on, talk about all those aspects of what was going on, about her anger, about her fear, about what she could actually do, whom she could actually talk to, how all of this brought up feelings from her own childhood about who was going to take care of her, how could she make something different happen for her niece than what happened for her and for her sister. And she kept in touch with me throughout the day, updating me, but also touching base with me to kind of just touch base with me to help calm her down. And she was able finally to talk with, I mean, it took hours and hours, but finally to talk with a supervisor who did give her permission, you know, and help her through the whole bureaucracy that she needed to go through just to have her niece spend a few nights with her. Understanding her history, understanding what it meant to her to, you know, to fail at this, and what it meant to her to succeed at it, and what it meant to have someone who was a steady presence and somebody who would call back meant a great deal to her and, you know, helped her through it.
Mm-hmm. And wasn't saying no, which was what she was getting from so many others.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And who, you know, acknowledged and, you know, that she was justified in feeling enraged and that this was unfair and made no sense to be treated the way she was being treated.
And both clinical situations, while on the one hand different, what they have in common is that you're both putting words to affects. Mm-hmm. And sharing that experience with them and your ability to do that. It's they're lovely examples. Before we finish, I do want to ask you both about yourselves. What you're doing is remarkable work. It's unusual for analysts to be doing this work. Can you share with us whatever you're comfortable with, what it is in you that leads you here?
Well, I've always been interested in infancy in very early states of mind. My doctoral dissertation was an infant study on object permanence and integrating aspects of Piagetian and separation individuation theories. And Annie Bergman, who had also been a clinical supervisor in my doctoral program, was on my dissertation committee. So that's always been an interest of mine, but really, after analytic training, after my own analyses, after being in, you know, and going through the Annie Bergman Parent Infant Program myself, and then winding up working with Rita and Annie and Beatrice Beebe and a few other people, Phyllis Cohn and Mark Sossin and Donna Dimitri Friedman and Susie Tortora on the September 11th, the Widows and Children of September 11th project, it wasn't until then that I realized what my real interest in this had been and where it came from. And it was during a conversation with one of the other therapists when I realized I was very identified with the babies and tried to think about why I was so identified with the babies that I put together that my own mother had given birth to me after experiencing extreme trauma and loss. And that I knew, you know, in my body and bones what it felt like to grow up in that. and, you know, in some way was trying to get back to that and, you know, help mothers and babies navigate that very difficult terrain.
I appreciate your sharing that. Rita?
You know, I am the third girl in a family of four children, although I think it was in some ways a good family. It was also a complicated family and not really so rosy. I did, however, get certain things from each parent that I think have been important. From my father, a real interest in sort of innovation and in starting things up and in taking some risks. And from my mother, who was more of a social activist, some real concern about problems of poverty and issues about education and anti-Semitism. And so those were topics and features of my growing up. I took a different route into psychoanalysis. I became a nursery school teacher and spent a lot of time with very young children in a nursery program. And so I learned a lot about normal children before learning a lot about what can go wrong. I could see the wide range of what could go well. And that was a terrific background for me. So I did that graduate degree in child development before coming into the world of psychoanalysis. Certainly my own analysis has been very important and very reparative. But I think also the experience with Annie Bergman is something I want to mention. And that is that she had a kind of innovative spirit that was somewhat similar to me, to my father. That is, she had a vision about how things could work out, how a program could map out. Her skills were not nearly as great in the realm of how to do it, but she could see it. And so I did team up with her very early on in helping to create this program. And that was an exciting, innovative time of my life to imagine starting with something that didn't exist and putting together first the educational part of it. And then gradually over the years, we have built these other components. And I think a part of it that is very pleasurable to me is the collegial aspect, that is growing a family of sorts among colleagues outside of the privacy or the at times loneliness of the office. And so working with Sally and growing this family or these pieces, these components of these programs has been very rewarding and very innovative to me, very creative.
Yeah, and really fun working together on it. I think also something about Annie is that she was always able to, you know, to sort of find the joy and pleasure in whatever situation she was in or whatever clinical situation she was hearing about or participating in. And I think we learned a lot from her about that, you know, listening to the way she listened to clinical material, to infant observations, the way she could find the pleasure in a mother and baby's interaction that maybe nobody else was seeing. She could find it.
And how beautifully you transmit that to the patients you work with. You described sort of bringing that eye, that ear, that listening to the people you're seeing. So there's a generational transmission from Annie to you, to your students, and to your patients, both the mothers and the babies. Listening to both of you, I'm struck by the spirit and theme of generosity. You're generous with your sensibility, you're generous with your heart, you're generous with your time, and you're also generous with me and the listeners, with yourselves, about being so honest and straightforward about who you are as people and how that influences the work that you do and the work for all of us that we do. So I want to thank you for, on my behalf and on the behalf of the listeners who perhaps like Annie Bergman will be smiling and listening to this report of really very important and graceful work that you've been able to bring to these patients.
Well, thank you very much for
interviewing
us.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.